You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to tell you that David Stockman is back with us again today. David is a prolific writer who provides economic insights in real time to his subscribers every day. As a former congressman from Michigan and head of the Office of Management and Budget under President Reagan, followed by a stint on Wall Street, David provides a unique viewpoint of what is transpiring in our economy and in our society in general. And what also makes him even more unique is his understanding of why limited meddling by government in the economy is for everyone's good and why it is essential for a well-functioning democracy. David understands why our founding fathers were wise in believing that the best government is the least government. But to give you an idea of the kind of topics that David writes about and that I enjoy reading every day, here's a couple of the more recent ones. On June 14th, the Great Reckoning has begun. June 15th, calling Paul Volcker. And then more recently, July 4th, the recession has landed. The bubble's days are numbered. July 5th was no inflation is not rolling over. No, inflation is not rolling over. July 6th was the monetary brakes will stay engaged. July 7th, Joe Biden's strategic petroleum reserve caper, a triple bogey. On June 8th, David commented on jobs, and he knows a lot about the statistics of government and how they're calculated and so forth. Still more born-again jobs, in other words, make jobs, fake jobs, whatever. And then July 11th, nanny state socialism and the existential test of democracy ahead. Well, we can only talk about a couple of things. Obviously, David, the ones I wanted to focus on primarily have to do with no, inflation is not rolling over, and the monetary brakes will stay engaged. Those are the ones that I want to ask David about. I should mention before we go any further that you can sign up for David's very inexpensive newsletter. It's, as I say, he's a prolific writer, writes daily on issues that are current and very apropos to your investment strategy, and that's davidstockmanscontracorner.com, davidstockmanscontracorner.com. ContraCorner.com. Welcome, David, and thank you so much for joining me again.
Well, glad to be with you, Jay, and that was quite a range of topics you cited there, so well, we have a lot to talk about.
Well, that's quite a range of topics. You always you provide, I think, provocative topics and topics that are very apropos to what's going on, very current, I should say. So I'm wondering, I'd like to focus on why inflation is not rolling over. And then, as time permits, perhaps get into why the monetary brakes will stay engaged. Certainly, the ruling elite and policymakers were not at all concerned when we had a serious dose of inflation in the financial markets. But now the consumer prices are heading towards double-digit territory. Policymakers are seemingly in a panic. Why do you think they're so concerned about one kind of inflation and not the other?
Well, because I guess the first kind was a happy kind of inflation for Wall Street, you know, from the recovery time after the great financial crisis in 2008, 2009, the stock market relentlessly rose. Every dip was an opportunity to buy. Everybody was fat and happy, and they thought they were wealthier. So what the Fed was doing with this massive expansion of its balance sheet and money printing was, widely applauded by Wall Street. And so they decided there wasn't any inflation visible, so why not pump the money even harder? I guess a lot of people know the statistics, but again, it's worth remembering. At the eve of the great financial crisis in early 2008, the Fed's balance sheet was $900 billion. It had taken nearly a century to get there from the cold start when the Fed was opened in 1914. And yet, by the peak a few weeks ago, really, the balance sheet was $9 trillion. In other words, in that short period of time, barely 14 years, the balance sheet of the Fed expanded by tenfold. And obviously, you don't create fiat credit out of thin air, pump it into the financial markets, from which it then spreads throughout both the financial system and the economy, without some pretty untoward impacts. But initially, the impact, as I said, was inflated financial asset prices, stock prices that went to the moon, crypto prices that, you know, increased by insane amounts, at least for a couple year period of time. But eventually, you know, the effort caught up with them as the forces which kept prices down globally suddenly were disrupted. In other words, the reason we didn't have goods and services inflation during that decade-long post-crisis recovery was there was a massive offshoring of the U.S. economy to China and other low-wage countries. That kept the price of goods and imports down. In fact, they were actually declining substantially during that period. And so we had a false sense that, you know, there wasn't any inflation and that you could print money at will. But that was just a one-time downshift in the cost structure of the global economy and of goods and services that couldn't possibly last and, in fact, became totally disrupted when, you know, the whole COVID lockdown, shutdown, discombobulation of the global economy took hold in 2020. And since then, you know, the favorable impact of offshoring has disappeared. The price of goods and imports have soared. And the underlying inflation, which was always there in goods and services, has now come to the surface, you know, aggressively. And we're about ready to get another inflation report tomorrow, which, by all indications, is likely to be pushing 9% year over year, which would be like a 42-year high, as far as I can compute. Mm-hmm. So the Fed is in deep trouble. It falsely assumed that the happy stock market was a sign that it was doing the right thing, when clearly it was over the top in its money pumping. Now the chickens have come home to roost. The Fed is way, way behind the curve. It will have no choice but to keep the monetary brakes on hard, even if the economy softens or actually fractures and rolls over into recession later this year, early next year, which I fully expect to happen. And so what we have is the worst of all possible worlds. They used to call it stagflation. I guess that's a good term. We're going to be still experiencing 6, 7, 8, 9% inflation, maybe even more, because there are a lot of prices still going up, like housing and rents and shelter, medical care. And we're going to be dealing with rising unemployment and a contracting GDP at the same time, and the Fed is going to find itself paralyzed, unable to open the spigots for monetary stimmies because it has an inflation rate that is 3 or 4 times its target, and its credibility will be totally on the line. So that's kind of a summary of the gigantic mess that we're in and of the hellacious corner into which the Fed has actually painted itself.
Well, are there some signs, perhaps, that this, teeny-weeny bit of QT that's been put into effect so far is having some impact on prices? Oil, for example, was down $7 today, $8, I don't know exactly. It's under $100. Yeah. Barrel, it was as high as $120. They're going to throw us into recession, it seems almost certainly that we're probably already in one. I think that's, if you look at the Atlanta Fed's numbers, And so do you think that a recession can kill the inflation? Can they get back to that 2% target, which is stupid anyway, that they have to have a any target, but that's what they were, they want to go, they say. What kind of a recession, how much of a downturn will it take, do you think, to smack inflation back down to those levels?
Yeah, I don't see it coming back to 2% if that were a valid goal, which it isn't. We should have no inflation. But I don't see it coming back to 2% for many, many quarters, maybe even years, because the underlying inflationary momentum is now set in. Wages are rising far faster than 2%. In some sectors, I mean, if you look at on the margin, like, say, leisure and hospitality, where services are coming back, restaurants are reopening, and, you know, all the things we know, you know, wages have been rising at double-digit rates. And, of course, labor is the number one cost in restaurants and other parts of the service economy, hotels, resorts, etc. So those prices are going to continue to rise. Look at airline travel. That's obviously coming back. People haven't traveled. They want to travel. Prices are soaring. And there's no sign that that's going to abate because wage pressures are even stronger. Then if we look at the CPI in terms of how it's constructed, 40% of the weight in the so-called core CPI, which is what the Fed, you know, looks at, CPI less food and energy, it doesn't make sense to me, but if you want to look at that, and they do as some kind of benchmark, 40% of that is accounted for by shelter. That is, rents that people pay who are rental renters and so-called owner's equivalent rent that homeowners are charged with, at least in terms of the way the CPI is constructed. So, you know, if we look at market measures of rents, okay, that come from various private sources, they're up by 15 to 20% on a year-over-year basis because, you know, more and more people have been priced out of the ownership market because the Fed has inflated home prices, you know, at 20% year-over-year in the latest reading. So we're going to have the CPI, which has a mechanism, by the way, in which lags what's actually happening in the true rental market. We're going to have the CPI for rents rising not at 5% where it was at the latest reading, but it's going to be going towards double digits, and it's got all that weight. So, yes, maybe gasoline prices will come off the boil a little bit, and food doesn't seem to be rolling over yet, but even if it flattens out, you're going to have shelter costs continuing to rise. You're going to have a lot of service sector costs pushed by wages continuing to rise. So I don't think inflation is about ready to roll over at all. And in fact, it's going to take one extended period of a weak economy before this inflationary momentum and incipient inflation psychology is finally broken. And I think if people believe that it's all going to be cleared up by the fourth quarter or early next year, I think they're really delusional. It's going to take a lot longer, and it's going to be a lot more painful to correct the mess that the Fed is and other central banks have generated over the last decade or two.
Right. Well, certainly this inflation problem is a two-pronged problem. It's created, we saw the money that was created out of thin air and distributed, the checks sent out to Americans. So that demand spiked as a result of that. And then we're seeing, of course, the supply and the oil prices and not in no small part of what you warned about the last time you were on our show. Was about the time that Mr. Putin was going into the Ukraine and Biden was threatening his sanctions and removing Russia from the SWIFT system. And at that time, you said if he does that, it's crazy as hell, I think, is the words you used. Yeah. To what extent do you think this inflation problem is a supply problem that's related to these sort of geopolitical issues? We started out with COVID, of course. COVID. And China locking down the way they did and still are from time to time, keeping supplies off the world market. So to what extent do you think it's a supply issue, and to what extent is it a demand issue? And you know, what kind of relief might, if any, we see from these geopolitical stresses?
Yeah, those are good questions, and I think absolutely it is a supply issue. And it's not only the sanctions war, which has totally backfired, and we can talk about some of the data that proves that, but also, you know, the green energy crusade has only compounded the problem. If you look at the data, we have had a tremendous fall off in fossil fuel investment in refineries, in upstream oil and gas drilling, and you know, new field discovery, to say nothing of regular day in, day out production. We've had a tremendous fall off in investment during the last several years, and that's catching up with us. So the world drained the inventories pretty much over the last 2 or 3 years. Then came the sanctions war. Russian supply has been reduced by 2 to 3 million barrels a day or more out of 11. That's affected the global energy balance, which is very sensitive. And when you lose supply in a context in which, at least for the moment, demand was recovering and inventories were at the bottom of the historic range, well, of course, you had a perfect formula for soaring prices. And so almost in a heartbeat, we went from a $50 to $60 oil price range to $100 to $120. You know, in the last couple of days, it's, you know, dropped towards the bottom of that range. But I don't think we're out of the woods at all, because if the Washington and the NATO crazies continue to try to tighten the screws with even more far out sanctions, and of course Europe is trying to cut off seaborne Russian oil entirely by year end, you could have prices soaring not only to 120 again, but far higher. In fact, J.P. Morgan has an analysis which shows that if they actually implemented this crazy oil price cap scheme that's being pushed by, of all people, Secretary Janet Yellen, and whenever she's behind something, you need to, you know, get prepared for the worst. You know, prices could go to $200, they say even $300 a barrel, because of the disruption that would likely occur. So the supply side is still tremendously at risk. The supply side is still being ground lower by the lack of investment. And, you know, we have the total uncertainty among producers in the energy sector as to whether they should be investing at all.
Right.
I mean, this green energy crusade is nuts. It's crazy. You've seen what's been happening in Europe in the last few weeks,
right,
with the Dutch farmers you know, clogging the roads with their tractors because they're trying to outlaw nitrogen fertilizer.
Right.
Now,
right.
When you get to the point where you're outlawing nitrogen fertilizer and telling cattle farmers they got to shoot their herds, this is as dumb as anything FDR did during the 1930s.
Yeah.
So, again, I think it's another measure that the supply side is very much at risk.
David, we only have 2 minutes left. I want to ask you, what do you think it would take to cause Powell to change, to pivot? I mean,
that's a big thing. You know, a lot of the people who were kind of anti-Fed and cynical about the Fed, and there's every reason to be, you know, these Keynesian central bankers have no clue as to what they're doing. But I'm of the school that says I don't think the Fed is going to pivot to ease at any time soon, because they're in a total panic about the public reaction to 6, 7, 8, maybe tomorrow 9% inflation. They fear that it could lead to a political reaction that would curtail or substantially interfere with their vaunted independence. And that's the last thing they want. They're the masters of the universe right now. They're unelected dictators of the entire financial system. And from that perch, the entire economy, both here and abroad. So they are going to do everything they can to show themselves to be on the case, trying to grind down this tremendous inflation that is eating alive middle class budgets and living standards. So I don't think they're going to pivot this time. I think they're going to have to hang in there with their feet heavily on the brakes, and that will put the economy into recession. But you know how it goes. People will argue for weeks or months or quarters that, well, was a little bit of a hiccup, but there are signs here and there, green shoots, all the rest of it, that it's not so bad, and so therefore this recession is going to be short-lived, or it hasn't even happened, or, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right.
And you're going to have that narrative.
Okay, we are going to have to leave it go at that, David. I mean, we just got it started here with things that are really, really important. I hope we can talk to you sometime soon again. But we are out of time, so regrettably we have to go. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
Well folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Chris Powell of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee will be with me. Michael Oliver and Dr. Quentin Henning will be here to talk about Lion One Metals. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.